maintained regretfully with resignation. The Queen's instincts were more humane than those of her predecessors, but too many contemporaries were trying to kill her. Unlike her sister, Elizabeth never burned men for their faith, her recent biographer Lisa Hilton has written. She tortured and hanged them for treason. Toleration, Machiavelli might have said, had turned against Elizabeth. She wanted to be loved. Who wouldn't? It was definitely safer for princes, though, to be feared. 7. Philip gave Elizabeth more to fear when he took over Portugal in 1580. That country had pioneered long-distance ocean navigation a century earlier. Now its ships and sailing skills served Spain. Elizabeth had made the most of her smaller navy by sending Sir Francis Drake on a 3-year voyage around the world, the first since Magellan's, showing that no seas were safe for Spanish treasure. But although profitable in the extreme for Drake, his queen, and his investors, the expedition didn't change the fact that if Philip ever combined his fleet with his army in the Netherlands, acknowledged to be the best anywhere, and now under the command of Alba's successor, the Duke of Parma, it might be difficult indeed to save England. Elizabeth responded with more pinpricks, none painful enough to reverse the unfavorably shifting balance of power. She increased subsidies to the Dutch rebels and, for the first time, sent English troops to fight alongside them. These measures did little, though, to hinder Parma. She dispatched Drake, also with infantry, to the West Indies, where he raided ports and captured more booty, but failed to hold any permanent base. Meanwhile, plots against the Queen continued, any one of which, if successful, could leave no alternative to Mary Stuart. Walsingham's agents turned up 3 in as many years between 1583 and 1585. After Parliament made conversion to Catholicism treasonable, priests were regularly executed in England. Mary remained, however, a counter-reformation center of gravity, the instrument whereby the perils do grow, as Elizabeth's advisor Lord Burleigh put it. Still the Queen's prisoner in northern England, Mary hadn't abandoned her faith, her ambitions, or her appetite for conspiracy. That left Elizabeth in an awkward position. To kill a priest was one thing. To kill a former and possibly future queen was quite another. Elizabeth abhorred regicide, knowing its violent role in English history. Its use now would make her more bloodthirsty than Bloody Mary, who'd allowed the young Elizabeth to live. It would equate her morally with papal efforts to enforce orthodoxy by assassination. And it would risk an uncertain succession, for what was to prevent Mary Stuart's son, James VI, now King of Scots and brought up as a Protestant, from converting to Catholicism if he believed his mother to have been unjustly murdered? In the end, Elizabeth maneuvered masterfully. She bribed James to repudiate his mother while approving a parliamentary ban on any future Catholic monarch. She let Walsingham implicate Mary by forging documents in another plot that was real enough. Mary, unwisely, took the bait. After the conspirators were arrested, Elizabeth insisted on prolonged public executions. She then had Mary convicted of treason, expressed dismay at the verdict, and asked Parliament if the rogue queen's death was really necessary. Assured that it was, Elizabeth delayed approving the warrant until her counselors, in desperation, slipped it among a stack of papers awaiting her signature. She signed it casually, but made it clear later that she knew perfectly well what they thought they'd tricked her into doing. Fearing that Elizabeth would change her mind, they rushed the warrant north to Fotheringay, where Mary was being held. Her execution followed quickly. The date was February 8, 1587, and Elizabeth was quickly informed. She appeared at first undisturbed, but then pulled off one of the greatest public performances of her life, weeping hysterically, protesting that she'd been deceived, threatening to hang those responsible, and appearing for weeks to mourn the dead queen. It was like allowing, then disavowing, Drake. Now, though, with more craft and greater consequence, she had allowed and disavowed herself. 8. Mary's execution didn't dissuade Philip, however, from preparing to invade England. One reason was the acquisition of Portugal. If the Romans were able to rule the world simply by ruling the Mediterranean, the king's chaplain reminded him, what of the man who rules the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, since they surround the world? Another was the ease with which Philip's admiral, the Marquis of Santa Cruz, had ejected French, English, and rebel Portuguese forces from the Azores in 1582-83, thereby seeming to show the feasibility of amphibious operations. Still another came from a new pope, Sixtus V, who insisted as adamantly as his predecessors that it was Philip's divinely inspired duty to restore Catholicism in England. Philip found the papal pressure exasperating. Didn't the pope realize that suppressing Dutch rebels was also a holy cause? God should do his part by first securing that victory, after which Spain could conquer England. It wasn't possible to do everything at once. But then Elizabeth went beyond pinpricks. Having picked up rumors of an impending invasion, she authorized Drake to begin raiding Spain itself. His brief landing in Galicia in the fall of 1585 shocked Philip, who saw that it could be the first of many. Facing the prospect of having to defend the entire Iberian coastline, he convinced himself that the only way to defeat Drake would be to attack his home base. With this in mind, Philip focused, without further distraction, on the enterprise of England. Mary's death made no difference, other than to convince him that God now wanted him to succeed Elizabeth. God failed again, though, to provide the resources, circumstances, and organizational efficiency that this would require. Philip's micromanagement delayed preparations, as did Drake's continuing raids. Secrecy had long been lost, eliminating any hope of surprise. Strategy was unclear. How would the Armada, commanded now not by the experienced Santa Cruz, who died, but by the Duke of Medina Sidonia, who lacked seafaring skills, link up with Parma's army in the Netherlands to make the Channel crossing? The largest naval force ever assembled sailed from Lisbon in May 1588, only to run into a storm that scattered it, forcing repairs and resupply in the northern Spanish port of Corunna. Philip was undaunted. If this were an unjust war, one could indeed take the tempest as a sign from our Lord to cease offending him, he admonished the demoralized Duke. But I have dedicated this enterprise to God. Pull yourself together, then, and do your part. The world was never so dangerous, nor never so full of treasons and treacheries, as at this day, one of Elizabeth's favorites, the Earl of Leicester, had written her from the Netherlands a few months earlier. Her ports were better prepared for commerce than defense. She had no way of knowing how many of her subjects remained quietly Catholic. Parma was close to crushing the Dutch rebels. And Elizabeth's navy, however well trained, was no match numerically for Medina Sidonia's massive fleet, which appeared off Cornwall on July 29th. The Queen did, however, have a strategy. She'd first brought Drake home, knowing that her admirals could best confront the Armada in the English Channel, where they knew it would have to be. She foresaw no great battle, as at Salamis or Actium. Instead, her fleet would follow the Spanish ships, picking them off one by one while awaiting more promising opportunities, which Philip obligingly provided. Medina Sidonia's warships were supposed to protect Parma's barges as they carried his army to England. But the king's orders said nothing about timing or the means by which the admiral and the general would communicate, or how the winds and tides could bring the two fleets together from opposite directions, and then, at just the right moment, propel them in the same direction toward England. That was a lot to leave in God's hands. Medina Sidonia anchored off Calais on August 6th, having heard nothing from Parma. He, just up the coast in Flanders, was surprised to learn on the next day of the Armada's arrival. He hurried his troops onto their barges, only to discover that Sir Charles Howard, Elizabeth's Lord Admiral, had that night taken advantage of a favorable wind to rig fireships, forcing the Armada, in panic, to cut its anchor cables and disperse. Off Gravelines, on the next day, Howard's fleet battered the disorganized Spanish. Parma could only watch in frustration from the beaches. England, overnight, was again safe. Howard had improvised, knowing that his queen would approve. The English didn't defeat the Armada, but they wore it down, which amounted to the same thing. Reliant, throughout their voyage, on supplies taken on weeks earlier in Corunna, with no possibility now of replenishment in any friendly port, the Spanish had no option but to sail home the long way, across the North Sea, around the Shetlands, and down the inhospitable west coasts of Scotland and Ireland. The first ships didn't reach Spain until the third week in September. Of the 129 that left at the end of July, at least 50 were lost, and many of those returning had to be scrapped. Half the men who embarked for England died, most from wrecks, starvation, or disease. The toll may have been 15,000. The English, in contrast, lost only the 8 vessels sacrificed to the flames at Calais, and about 150 men. 9. I hope that God has not permitted so much evil, Philip wrote after the first reports of the disaster reached him, for everything has been done for his service. Soon, though, he was planning a new invasion, convinced that God, by inflicting adversity, had been only testing him. I undertake to deal with everything necessary to achieve all this. I shall never fail to stand up for the cause of God. Augustine, of course, had made a similar argument, but what God would test, he'd insisted, was proportionality in aligning ends with means. There was never, in Augustine, an injunction indiscriminately to expend earthly lives and treasure for heavenly purposes. To invade by sea upon a perilous coast, being neither in possession of any port nor succored by any party, may better fit a prince presuming on his fortune than enriched with understanding, Sir Walter Raleigh observed after the Armada had failed. Machiavelli could have said this. Augustine could have too, with the substitution of God for fortune. What made Philip, then, so persistently disproportionate? Geoffrey Parker, his best biographer, finds an answer in late 20th century prospect theory. Leaders, it suggests, risk more to avoid losses than to achieve gains. Given the empire Philip inherited and then expanded, he had a lot to lose. What's strange, though, are the risks he ran to regain territories he hadn't lost. It wasn't Philip's fault that Henry VIII broke with Rome, or that Mary Tudor failed to reverse his heresy. These misfortunes, together with the Protestant Reformation, could even have been God's punishment for centuries of papal excesses. Philip didn't see it that way, though. He was sure that God had entrusted him not just with the task of losing nothing more, but also with that of recovering for the Church its ancient and medieval universality. If God had placed your majesty under an obligation to remedy all the troubles of the world, Philip's private secretary suggested in 1591, he would have given you the money and strength to do so. I know you are moved by the great zeal you have for my service, the king replied, but you must also understand that these are not matters that can be abandoned by a person who is as conscientious about his responsibilities as you know me to be. The cause of religion must take precedence over everything else. It was one of many occasions on which Philip resorted to what Parker calls spiritual blackmail. When warned that his objectives exceeded his capabilities, the king would claim that those doing the warning themselves lacked faith. God would close the gap. When God didn't, Philip insisted that he would remain faithful, even if God's attention had wandered. God did indeed test Philip, but Philip didn't put himself beneath testing God. 10. Elizabeth tested God too, but for English patriotism, not Catholic universality. The shining glory of princely authority hath not so dazzled our eyes, she assured Parliament shortly before she died, but that we well know and remember that we also are to yield an account of our actions before the great judge. She showed no sign, though, of fearing the verdict. She delighted that God hath made me his instrument to maintain his truth and glory and to defend this kingdom. If queen and country were the same in her mind, so too, in God's, were truth and glory, and defending this kingdom. Certainty, however, never required haste. From the moment Elizabeth became queen, the historian A.N. Wilson has pointed out, her advisers and courtiers had been urging her to make decisions, to be Catholic or to be Protestant, to marry, to fight a decisive and expensive war in Ireland or the Low Countries. In almost all cases, Elizabeth had dithered, Hamlet-like. And dithering had been, if not the right policy, then at least not the wrong policy. For Elizabeth, like Hamlet, could see the calamitous effects of too great a precision and too great a decisiveness in political life. They hardly, at first, seem similar. Shakespeare's prince, dressed like Philip, always in black, lacks Elizabeth's likeness, except in his mad scenes where he feigns irresponsibility, even lunacy, to smoke out his enemies. Elizabeth used dithering, which looks irresponsible, in something like the same way, to remind her advisers for whom they worked, to hold off her suitors, thus balancing their states, and, when the balance at last turned against her, to lure the Spanish Armada into the English Channel, where, by trusting her admirals, she sprang a massive mousetrap. Precision and decisiveness, in each of these situations, could have entrapped her. This god-daughter of Cranmer, the liturgical master of Hendiadys, Wilson concludes, has seen the wisdom of doublethink. My dictionary defines Hendiadys as a complex idea expressed by two words connected by a copulative conjunction, or, less lustily, how two things can be, or become, one. How, for example, could a new religion, conceived in the lust of an English king, replace a faith souls had followed for 1,000 years? Perhaps by speaking to them, without condescension, in their own tongue. Cranmer's Book of Common Prayer, Wilson shows, rolls out majestic Hendiadys, bringing unforgettable clarity to a language still young enough to be growing. Almighty and most merciful Father, we have erred and strayed from thy ways like lost sheep. We have followed too much the devices and desires of our own hearts. Behold our most gracious sovereign lady, Queen Elizabeth. Grant her in health and wealth long to live. Strengthen her that she may vanquish and overcome all her enemies. And finally, after this life, she may attain everlasting joy and felicity. Hendiadys can seem to say the same thing. Erred and strayed, devices and desires, health and wealth, vanquish and overcome, joy and felicity. But their combinations can also introduce, so deftly that one hardly notices, contradictions. Almighty and most merciful Father, or our most gracious sovereign lady. Raising the possibility that a father may forgive, that a lady may rule, and that a virgin queen may save a state and leave a legacy. These were new possibilities, which Elizabeth opened triumphantly. As, from a distance, she encouraged Shakespeare, who peppered his plays and poems not just with new words, but with such rich redundancies, "How weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world." That, as Wilson puts it, he stretched and expanded the English language, thereby giving to all who spoke it a larger vocabulary and hence a larger capacity to describe experience. And, hence, to manage it. For if, as Thucydides warned 2,000 years earlier, words in crises can lose their meaning, leaving in the ability to see all sides of a question and incapacity to act on any, then Shakespeare and his great queen found safety in multiple meanings, some repetitive, some opposed, but also implanted as to make them unforeseeably applicable. Hendiadys positioned a culture against paralysis in a world that was to come. 11. On a warm July evening of the year 1588, in the royal palace of Greenwich, a woman lay dying, an assassin's bullets lodged in abdomen and chest. Her face was lined, her teeth blackened, and death lent her no dignity. But her last breath started echoes that ran out to shake a hemisphere. The word reached the great ships, and for a day, Medina Sidonia paced the decks. Then his decision was made, and one by one the galleons and carracks, the galleys and the lumbering urcas turned northward towards the land, towards Hastings, where history had been made once centuries before. Philip II becomes again King of England. The Protestant Reformation collapses throughout Europe. Spain rules all of South and North America. Captain Cook plants the papal flag in Australia. To some, the years that passed were years of fulfillment, of the final flowering of God's design. To others, they were a new dark age, haunted by things dead and others best forgotten. Overall, the long arm of the popes reached out to punish and reward. The church militant remained supreme. Keith Roberts's 1968 novel, Pavan, portrays what might have happened had history pivoted 380 years earlier in only a slightly different way. His 1960s, it's then that he sets his tale, is an England of transportation by steam tractors, illumination by candles, and communication by semaphores, for Rome has banned petroleum, electricity, and telegraphy. Radio, allowed only to a secretive guild, is otherwise necromancy. Politics are authoritarian, education is limited, and memory is dim. One of those minor Elizabethans, a character explains, having recalled, unexpectedly, a few lines from Richard III. We had him at school. I forget his name. I thought he was rather good. Pavan seems sufficiently anti-Catholic to have made the papal index if it hadn't been abolished in 1966, until another character advises, also unexpectedly, do not despise your church, for she has a wisdom beyond your understanding. Rome, it turns out, has had modern technology, even nuclear expertise, all along, but has held it back until civilization catches up and can use it wisely. Did she hang and burn? A little, yes. But there was no Belsen, no Buchenwald, no Paschendala. Only an ancient but real Armageddon from which this knowledge came. This last twist makes Roberts's novel Hendiadic. The church, more than anyone suspects, masters contradictions, and therefore links the cities of God and man. It's only, of course, a novel. But counterfactuals, like ghosts, should haunt historians. It's all very well to say that Augustine is in heaven and Machiavelli is in hell. Where, though, is Philip? If there's a God, and he's really Catholic, then the king, ever faithful, ranks among the grandest strategists of all time. And Elizabeth? Machiavelli would, for her, for eternity, at least be good company. Chapter 6. New Worlds. It's not counterfactual to claim that the real events of 1588 in the English Channel echoed loudly and long enough to shake a hemisphere. The previous century had seen the Portuguese and the Spanish, neither hitherto seismically significant, exploiting a new understanding of ships, sails, winds, and currents to explore and conquer immensities of strange new things. Non sufficit orbis, Philip II's motto for his Iberian kingdoms and the empire they'd acquired, was eloquently apt. Eurasia, the old world into which all earlier empires had fit, had indeed not been enough. As the Armada left Lisbon that summer, few from whom it faded from sight would have anticipated anything other than enduring Catholic monarchies throughout what had become known as America. For how could God not be on the side of the Christian kingdoms of Castile and Aragon that had, in the single year 1492, expelled their Muslim neighbors, ejected their Jews, and almost as an aside, expanded the size of the earth? Or, in the year that followed, gained title to the new territories, together with Portugal, by papal edict? Or, as Spain, required only 3 years to conquer Mexico and not many more to control Peru, thereby ensuring apparently endless supplies of gold and silver? Or, using these riches, imposed administrative and even architectural uniformity on two unfamiliar continents? Or, mapped out, for their diverse inhabitants, a single path to salvation? Accomplishments on this scale require more than self-confidence. They presume knowledge of and correspondence with God's will. 235 years after the Armada sailed, however, a staunchly Protestant statesman in the swampy new capital of a secular state was drafting an equally presumptuous proclamation for his Republican sovereign, that the American continents, by the free and independent condition which they have assumed and maintain, are henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonization by any European powers. When Secretary of State John Quincy Adams made the Monroe Doctrine a motto for the United States of America in 1823, that country lacked the means of securing the New World against its old masters. It had the self-confidence, though, of Spain in its prime. And that, Adams saw, would suffice. The failure of the Spanish Armada, Jeffrey Parker has argued, laid the American continent open to invasion and colonization by Northern Europeans, and thus made possible the creation of the United States. If that's right, then the future pivoted on a single evening, August 7th, 1588, owing to a favorable wind, a clever Lord Admiral, and a few fiery ships. Had he succeeded, Philip would have required Elizabeth to end all English voyages to America. But from the moment his captains cut their anchor cables, Spain began a slow decline, and a new world order its gradual ascendancy. 1. The English, at the time of the Armada, had barely begun overseas expansion. The word colony to them meant Ireland. Newfoundland, whose shores they'd visited, meant fish. Exploration meant joint stock companies, the first of which had a grand title, the Mystery, Company, and Fellowship of Merchant Adventurers for the Discovery of Unknown Lands, etc., but an ill-conceived mission. It directed its energies, in an age of global cooling, toward finding trade routes to China through Hudson's Bay and around northern Russia. Drake's circumnavigation of 1577 to 80 signaled Elizabeth's curiosity about wider worlds. By then, though, Spain had for half a century controlled the Caribbean, Mexico, and large portions of South America. Sir Walter Raleigh's Roanoke, the first English settlement in North America, came only in 1584-85, but quickly and humiliatingly failed. Despite Spain's lead, Elizabeth refused to rush. She let her merchants risk their ships and settlers, but not her navy or treasury. She encouraged Drake to spook the Spanish, while under no illusion that his raids alone could secure her state. She sought self-sufficiency in overseas enterprises, sensing the shortcomings of Philip's micromanagement. She took interest only when convinced that others had interests, chiefly, though not exclusively, commercial. She set the template, thereby, for British America, a hodgepodge of colonies lacking common purpose, bound more to the sea and to England than to each other, strung out thinly along 1,000 miles of coastline from Massachusetts to Georgia, and for the most part lightly, even absent-mindedly, administered. Spanish America, by the 1750s, had 6 times the population and many more times the size and wealth of its northern counterpart. Its great cities, serviceable roads, and standard practices rivaled those of the Roman Empire. There was nothing absent-minded about it. The historian John Eliot has pointed out that a Mexico City gentleman visiting Lima, 2,600 miles to the south, would have felt entirely at home. Civic institutions were identical, the forms of worship the same. This wouldn't have happened in the British colonies, where differing local backgrounds, differing motives for emigration, and differing religious beliefs and practices created a mosaic of communities settled at a diversity of times and in a diversity of ways. Imagine the young John Adams, John Quincy's father, among the planters of Virginia or the slave owners of South Carolina. The clash of cultures would have been almost as great as if he'd been in Lima. Spain, like Rome, imposed uniformities on particularities. This could produce impressive results. It's unlikely, otherwise, that either empire would have expanded so far so fast. The price, though, was shallow roots, which allowed adversity to shake authority. The English spread their influence more slowly, but adapted more easily, especially in North America, where, when trouble came, it brought a Republican revolutionary transfer of authority, not a collapse, the example of which, over the next 2 centuries, would undermine empires everywhere. 2. How, though, could lightness, even absent-mindedness, lead to such an outcome? The answer, I think, lies in fitting foundations to the ground on which they rest. A heavy hand and a focused mind can appear to achieve monumentality, but only by smoothing out, if not flattening, topography, somewhat in the manner of Xerxes and modern highways. You can't do this, though, all the way down, for the Earth's irregularities reflect its nature. Continents move, slide, collide, and override. Assuming stability is one of the ways ruins get made. Resilience accommodates the unexpected. There can be reasons, therefore, for resisting uniformity, for respecting topography, even for dithering. Elizabeth ruled in this way, pioneering such innovations as reigning without marrying, tolerating, within limits, religious differences, and letting a language gloriously grow. Each arose in response to circumstances. None reflected grand designs. Joint stock companies could be similarly flexible. The absence of close control by the British Crown in the early stages of colonization, Eliot points out, left considerable latitude for the evolution of those forms of government that seemed most appropriate to the people actively involved in the process of overseas enterprise and settlement, the financial backers of the enterprise and the colonists themselves, as long as they operated within the framework of their royal charter. in contrast to Spain's New World colonies and to the territories that France, more recently, had claimed but barely settled along the banks of the St. Lawrence, the Great Lakes, and the Ohio and Mississippi rivers, British America was a society whose political and administrative institutions were more likely to evolve from below than to be imposed from above. That made it a hodgepodge, but also a complex adaptive system. Such systems thrive, theorists tell us, from the need to respond frequently, but not too frequently, to the unforeseen. Controlled environments encourage complacency, making it hard to cope when controls break down, as they sooner or later must. Constant disruptions, however, prevent recuperation. Nothing's ever healthy. There's a balance, then, between integrative and disintegrative processes in the natural world, an edge of chaos, so to speak, where adaptation, especially self-organization, tends to occur. New political worlds work similarly. 3. British North Americans lived simultaneously on several edges of a vast but navigable ocean, of a continent claimed by Spain in the south and France to the north and west, of the disruptions unleashed at home by Elizabeth's gyroscopically inept successors. She'd so skillfully charmed, intimidated, cajoled, deferred to, and ignored Parliament that there was never a direct confrontation between them. The first Stuarts, however, went out of their way to pick fights they couldn't win. They also blurred the late Queen's distinction between what men believed and what they did, in effect playing with matches as Europe was stumbling into the religiously fueled 30 Years' War. By 1642, civil war had erupted in England, so confusingly that historians still debate who fought whom for what. 7 years later, however, that conflict cost Charles I his head. The violence multiplied reasons for emigration, as did the promise, upon arrival in America, of commercial opportunities, the toleration of multiple faiths, and the prospect of lighter-handed rule. Heavy-handed domestic distractions, even under Oliver Cromwell, a failed Republican experiment, left little choice from London's perspective but to allow a colonial mosaic of communities. By the time Charles II made lightness his path to restoration in 1660, heterogeneity had established itself across the Atlantic. Charles's lazy, long, and lascivious reign ended in 1685 with the accession of his bull-headed brother James II, whose incumbency possessed only the last of these qualities. A staunch Catholic, he set out to return England to Rome while modernizing it on the centrally administered model of France's Louis XIV. The colonies were soon to follow. But when, 3 years later, the birth of a son made a Catholic succession likely, William of Orange, the Protestant Dutch husband of James's Protestant daughter Mary, launched the most successful cross-channel invasion since that of an earlier William in 1066. James was overthrown. William and Mary replaced him, and the Americans were left to themselves once again. The Revolution of 1688 ensured, for them, continued evolution, even as it justified, by the precedent it set, resistance to future efforts to reverse what had been permitted to evolve. The lessons of 1688, its chief ideologist John Locke argued, were that there can be but one supreme power, which is the legislative, to which all the rest are and must be subordinate. Yet there remains still in the people a supreme power to remove or alter the legislative. The principles seem at odds. How can supremacy share? But within that puzzle, the modern historian Robert Toombs has suggested, lay the foundations of England's post-Stuart political culture. Suspicion of utopias and zealots, trust in common sense and experience, respect for tradition, preference for gradual change, and the view that compromise is victory, not betrayal. These things stem from the failure of both royal absolutism and of godly republicanism, costly failures and fruitful ones. Their odor, Machiavelli's useful word, was Elizabethan, although Her Majesty wouldn't have welcomed a constitutional monarchy. She would have seen benefits, though, in balancing opposites. She practiced that art every day. She'd have thought her successor's efforts to reconcile opposites dangerously foolish. She understood political horticulture, that things grow best when variety is allowed and roots aren't too closely examined. So she probably would have approved of Edmund Burke. 4. Who rose in Parliament on March 22, 1775, to explain what Britain's Americans had become. They were, Burke noted, a recent people, not yet hardened into the bone of manhood. They'd shown a hardy industry bred from an inheritance of English freedom, homegrown republicanism, diverse faiths, a profitable if uneasy dependence on slavery, a prickly litigiousness spawned by widespread literacy, and the self-reliance demanded by the 3,000 miles of ocean between you and them. Apart from a wise and salutary neglect, they owe little or nothing to any care of ours. In their achievements, I feel all pride of power sink, and all presumption in the wisdom of human contrivances melt. I pardon something to the spirit of liberty. Contrivances had indeed been few in British North American policy during the first half of the 18th century. Indecisively prolonged European wars, together with the rise, under a weakened monarchy, of distinctive political parties, left little time or energy for ambitious colonial projects. Meanwhile, the insouciance of the Americans, when given instructions, made it easier not to try. I imagined, like most young beginners, that I should be able to make a mighty change in the face of affairs, a chastened colonial governor wrote in 1737. But a little experience of the people and reflection on the situation of things at home has absolutely cured me of this mistake. Such looseness, though, could hardly last. The colonies were doubling their population every 25 years. Benjamin Franklin pointed out in 1751. In a century, the greatest number of Englishmen will be on this side of the water. That made westward expansion imperative, but the French and their Native American allies blocked the way. When George Washington, then a young colonel, failed to retake a British frontier fort in 1754, a new war broke out. Known for the 7 years it took to fight, the struggle soon spread to Europe, India, and the high seas. Its most dramatic event was the French loss of Quebec to the British in 1759, which in turn forced France's withdrawal altogether from North America. The Peace of Paris of 1763 looked like an Anglo-American triumph, but in fact it drove the victors apart. The war had focused official minds. Why, then, King George III's ministers asked, should post-war colonial administration again lose its focus? Shouldn't the Americans, by some calculations the least taxed of all people, pay more for the security they'd gained? Could the British, however cleverly financed now by the Bank of England, indefinitely accumulate debt? Shouldn't someone regulate trans-Appalachian settlement, preventing collisions between imported and indigenous Americans? What good was it even to have an empire if you weren't running it? For Americans used to a light touch, however, such questions suggested a heavy hand that, once applied, might not be withdrawn. Bewilderment followed, then resentment, and then, with the Stamp Act of 1765, active resistance. Possessing few means of enforcement at so great a distance, Parliament backed down, satisfying itself with the Declaratory Act of 1766, which reserved the right to revive what it had just repealed. Burke scathingly mocked the petulance. After you have made this law, you must make another to enforce that, and so on in endless rotation of vain and impotent efforts. Every great act you make must be attended with a little act, like a squire to carry his armor. The problem lay in Locke's opposed supremacies. The people must obey the government, but the government must reflect the will of the people. He'd meant that tightrope, though, for a small island. When stretched across a great ocean, where distance impeded reflection and empowered disobedience, it was too thin a thread. Burke saw the difficulty as early as 1769. The Americans have made a discovery, or think they have made one, that we mean to oppress them. We have made a discovery, or think we have made one, that they intend to rise in rebellion. Our severity has increased their ill behavior. We know not how to advance. They know not how to retreat. The only way out was to share dissatisfactions. All government, indeed every human benefit and enjoyment, every virtue, and every prudent act, is founded on compromise and barter. We balance inconveniences. We give and take. We remit some rights that we may enjoy others. But in all fair dealings, the thing bought must bear some proportion to the purchase paid. Burke concluded his 1775 speech with this peroration: "Deny the Americans this participation of freedom, and you break that sole bond which originally made and must still preserve the unity of the empire." 5. Burke's biographer David Bromwich has observed, with respect to a speech by George Grenville, George III's first minister at the time of the Stamp Act, that the end of its argument didn't remember its beginning. Grenville sought to show that an empire's center could prize its periphery's liberties while constraining them. Pericles, in his funeral oration, had attempted something similar. He began by praising the Athenians' respect for their colonies, but ended by extolling the use of force to keep them in line. Both forgot, before finishing, how they'd begun. They lost the proportioning of things bought to prices paid. The American revolutionaries had longer memories. Steeped as schoolboys in classical texts, if more often recalled in translation, they saw in the failures of Greek democracy and the Roman Republic compellingly immediate lessons. They revered what they believed to be Saxon common law, usurped by Normans, clawed back in Magna Carta, endangered by Stuarts, redeemed in 1688, but now at risk from the corruption of kings, parliaments, and colonial administrators. Their Declaration of Independence reinforced, even as it reflected, the intellectual liberations of 1776, Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, the first volume of Edward Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and most powerfully Thomas Paine's Common Sense, which found it repugnant to reason, to the universal order of things, to all examples from former ages, to suppose that this continent can longer remain subject to any external power. Monarchies had arisen, Paine insisted, not through merit, but because they'd outlasted memories. The first king had probably been only the principal ruffian of some restless gang. Certainly the example of William the Conqueror, a French bastard landing with an armed banditti and establishing himself King of England against the consent of the natives, hath no divinity in it. If nature respected monarchy, she wouldn't so often turn it into ridicule by giving mankind an ass for a lion. What sense could it make to have a youth of 21, George III had been 22 when he took the throne in 1760, say to several millions of people, older and wiser than himself, "I forbid this or that act of yours to be law"? Despite their small size and relative infrequency, republics since Rome's had done better. By encouraging equality, they diminished arrogance, and hence the amnesia that pride brings. Holland and Switzerland prospered peacefully in an age of ruinous monarchical rivalries. Americans themselves, as their colonial charters evolved into representative assemblies, had become republicans because left for so long to their own devices. Their lively trade and absence of gold and silver could secure us the peace and friendship of all Europe. So, what have we to do with setting the world at defiance? Independence was frightening only because its architecture was incomplete. How could 13 republics with continental ambitions stay together? Paine, on this point, was unsure. But what he did know was that a government of our own is our natural right, and that the need was urgent. Freedom hath been hunted round the globe. Asia and Africa have long expelled her. Europe regards her like a stranger, and England hath given her warning to depart. Oh, receive the fugitive, and prepare in time an asylum for mankind. Few ends of arguments have remembered, more ringingly, their beginnings. 6. Paine's pamphlet was the literary equivalent of Elizabeth's fireships, an incendiary device meant to unnerve an enemy, rally a defense, and make history pivot. Not all at once, of course. How to secure American independence, as opposed to proclaiming it, was not at all clear when common sense appeared in January 1776. What Paine did, though, was to shift psychologies. The British, like the Spanish in 1588, would retain, for the moment, military superiority. But they'd find it harder now to be confident that God or history, justice or reason, or simply the tilt of the arenas in which they competed, was on their side. Mr. Jefferson's declaration, 6 months later, hammered the point home. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect for the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. However hastily composed, Jefferson's words left the British tongue-tied, able only to continue what they'd begun at Lexington, Concord, and Bunker Hill the year before. The suppression of freedoms King and Parliament had claimed to respect. Jefferson was a genius, the historian Joseph Ellis has noted, at concealing contradictions within abstractions. The Virginian who insisted that all men are created equal, arrived in Philadelphia attended by opulently attired slaves. His declaration coupled universal principles with an implausibly long list of offenses, 27 in all, committed personally by George III. That's why the complete document can't be quoted today without sounding a little silly. Nor did Jefferson, any more than Paine, say anything about what kind of government might replace that of the British tyrant. Details weren't either patriot strength. Had they been, independence might never have been attempted, for details dim the flames fireships require. They disconnect ends of arguments from their beginnings. That's why Paine and Jefferson thought it necessary first to tilt history, and only at that point to begin to make it. Rhetoric, their lever, had to be clearer than truth, even if necessary, an inversion of it. George III was no Nero, not even a James II. Jefferson nonetheless struck from his indictments the charge that the king had supported the slave trade, for this would have slandered slavery's reputation. And that would have made the vote for freedom less than unanimous. As through such compromises, it turned out to be. An ideologically consistent declaration would have called forth, unimpressively, 13 disunited states of America. Nor would a uniform tone have caught the signatories' clashing emotions, patriotic rage, philosophical reflection, a somber sense of the bloodshed ahead, the conviction that eyes everywhere were watching, and an almost adolescent delight at having it in our power, as Paine put it, to begin the world over again. John Adams, who usually frowned on combustions beyond those of his own bad temper, was within the spirit of independence when he called for its anniversaries to be solemnized, after thanking God, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations, from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward forevermore. 7. Adams's pen hadn't slipped when he wrote continent, not country, for the authors of independence regularly fortified themselves with geography. Paine saw something very absurd in supposing a continent to be perpetually governed by an island. Franklin pointed out that the British had spent £3 million in 1775 to kill only 150 Yankees. During that year, 60,000 Americans had been born. How long would it take, and what would it cost, to kill us all? George Washington, now commanding the Continental Army, didn't have limitless space into which to retreat, but he had a lot. He also had an adversary capable of supply only by sea. So he relied on time, caution, and worrying the enemy, he later explained, until we could be better provided with arms and other means and had better disciplined troops to ensure victory. That could be done only by a government, however, and the Americans were unsure, in 1776, what kind they wanted. So they settled for governments, grounded in the interests of each state, linked loosely by Articles of Confederation. These established a league, but not a nation. There was no chief executive, no judicial review of legislation, and most significant, no authority to tax. It was as if the Americans had made salutary neglect their first constitution, but whether the lightness they'd liked in the old British Empire could extract them from the new one remain to be seen. For even on continents, armies could get trapped and forced to surrender. That's what happened to the British at Saratoga in 1777 and at Yorktown in 1781. They carried on after their first defeat, but gave up after the second. Would the Americans, in such circumstances, have fought on? The Confederation Congress so grudgingly supplied Washington that he lost all faith in it by the time peace was made in 1783. It is only in our united character as an empire, he warned, that our independence is acknowledged, that our power can be regarded, or our credit supported. What won the war for the Americans was a Machiavellian insight, that a constitutional monarchy's humiliation of an absolute monarchy could cause the latter, years later, to rescue a Republican revolutionary upstart. Still bitter over France's loss of North America to the British in 1763, Louis XVI welcomed rebel emissaries to Paris in 1776. The Americans offered trade vaguely, but revenge satisfyingly. The French responded with recognition, financing, and a perpetual military alliance. Their fleet's timely arrival off Yorktown forced the final British capitulation, whereupon the Americans blithely abandoned their ally to negotiate a settlement with agents of their enemy, extending their boundaries west to the Mississippi River. The outcome defied categories. Was it a victory for principle or expediency? For the rights of man or the rules of statecraft? For lightness of being or heaviness of hand? For a republic, or, as Washington himself put it, an empire? To say all of the above dodges the question, but usefully. For if Burke was right that governments should balance dissatisfactions, if Elizabeth was right to set precedents rather than be bound by them, if Machiavelli was right to prefer proportionality to consistency, then the Americans weren't just making it up as they went along. Even Augustus might have been impressed by what their leaders did next. They staged a second revolution to correct failures in the first, but with so skillful a mix of stealth and persuasion that the country didn't grasp, until after it had happened, what had just happened.